This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2017 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and previews upcoming performances. I'm Chris Moore. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Funding for Festival Showcase comes from the Barnard Fane Foundation. This Friday, August 11th at 8:30 at Harris Concert Hall, Piano Project List presents a free marathon performance with multiple pianists of List's late work, The Years of Pilgrimage. One of the pianists, Nietzsche Stapanukul, dropped by the Aspen Public Radio studio to talk about her part in this massive collective musical undertaking. But before we get to her, let's also talk with violist Daniel Avshalomov of the American String Quartet about their recital this Thursday, August 10th. Well, Daniel, you just drove into Aspen, so you haven't really had time to even unpack, so thank you for coming into the Aspen Public Radio first before doing anything else.
Well, first things first. I can unpack any time. I do it so many times each year, but speaking on the radio with you, once a year at best.
That's right. You are getting ready, of course, for your big recital on August 10th, and you're also going to be doing a little bit of teaching. Before we talk about your recital, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the advanced quartet studies. You've been a part of it for a while.
Since it started, yeah. Mm-hmm. Klaus Adam, who was then the cellist of the Juilliard Quartet, convinced a very broad-minded and wealthy donor named Jane Kitzelman into funding the advanced quartet studies program. He coached most of the groups and recruited them, but he had as his backup crew the members of the Cleveland Quartet and the members of the American Quartet.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, as he gave it up, he passed the mantle or the torch, depending on your image, to Earl Carlis. And Earl is taking a summer or maybe more than a summer off from that work. Mm-hmm. But the people who are doing the teaching are the quartets in residence.
I notice that the quartets in residence, when I hear them, there's something that they have that when you put four players together, they don't have. Maybe you could explain how it is that musicians gain a certain kind of nonverbal sensitivity to one another so that things come together in a way that they can't possibly.
There's no substitute for time spent. It's as simple as that. You can put together an all-star team with individual performers who are astonishing, but they will never have the kind of rapport or the understanding or the experience or, the, as you say, the unspoken exchange that a group that's played together for 10 or 20 or 30 or, in our case, more than 40 years together.
Mm-hmm.
We develop a shorthand in rehearsals and on stage so that we're never simply going through the motions of what we've agreed on in rehearsal. A performance is a live event for us in which any one of the four of us may fly off in a new direction. And if the others are alert, we can fly with them.
You better hope you are alert.
Yes, yes.
Is that part of what keeps it exciting? Is,
absolutely,
for example, surprising your colleagues in the American Quartet?
Oh, sure. And it's never with the aim of trying to surprise them. But one of my definitions of a masterwork is a piece of music to which you can return again and again and find new sustenance, new ideas, new knowledge. And a lot of that comes from holding this same quartet up to the light every night and holding it maybe at a slightly different angle and seeing something in it. And if it strikes you at the right way and you can communicate your discovery to your colleagues, off you go. And we're not talking about radical changes from night to night.
Right.
This is on a very small scale.
It's
it's like a mini version of what jazzers do every night.
Right. You have to play the same notes, but you can give different inflection or different emphasis to which notes the audience is more likely to hear.
Exactly.
Now, you're playing Haydn and Beethoven, two works and two composers who are very, very well known to audiences and to you all.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can talk about those two pieces first before we go into the Aspen premiere.
Oh, sure. Luckily, my colleagues aren't here in the room to hear me retell a story they've heard so many times they could do it with me in unison. But near the end of their career, the Budapest Quartet members were asked the hoary old question, if you had to choose just one composer whose music, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. I try not to ask that.
Yeah, I'm already grateful. But the woman who asked them that question was smart enough to ask them to write their answers down. Now, here the difference is that if she said, just say, they'd start debating, try to reach a consensus and behave exactly like a quartet. They'd start working on a quartet answer. Mm-hmm. But four pieces of paper and four pencil marks later, they each handed in their little pieces of paper, and all four of them had the name Haydn.
Fantastic.
And that is simply because none of us would be here without Papa Haydn. It's as simple as that. There would have been no Beethoven quartets, I think, without Haydn, or there certainly wouldn't have been as good Beethoven quartets.
Or
and
Mozart.
Right. Right. And Schubert. And Bartok. And go as far forward as you like.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that all we would do is play Haydn, but we're so grateful to him, and there's such immense variety of both expression and construction in his 60 or 70 or 80, depending on whose book you read, quartets, that we always delight in it. And the one we're playing, 76 number 5, he wrote at a point when he didn't have to prove anything to anybody. It's simply what he wanted to put down on a quartet, and each movement is more beautiful than the next.
What I love about Haydn is that if I ever start taking him for granted, all I have to do is hear a good performance of it. And he never ceases to surprise me. It never ceases to amaze me what's in those quartets. And it's subtle. It's you could play it as background music. It's really nice music to play at dinner. But boy, when you're sitting down and listening to it, there are a lot of surprises.
And he has wit.
Yes.
He has wit. Not necessarily just belly laughs, surprise symphony kind of things, but just little things. You hear the opening phrase and it comes back in the recap, and he's done one tiny thing to it. And if you're really paying attention, you get it.
Did Haydn learn by that time? I guess this is later in his life. He had actually studied under a former student of his, I guess you could say, Mozart. Is it fair to say that Haydn taught Mozart everything he knew and then Mozart taught Haydn a few things before he exited this planet?
Yeah, it wasn't really as formal as right. teaching and study. But Mozart, gifted as he was and inventive as he was, made a very close study of those Haydn quartets that were then being premiered.
Mm-hmm.
He heard them, he played them. He played viola, as a lot of good composers do. And he studied the scores. And then he wrote pieces showing what he had learned from Haydn. Haydn, having both ability and modesty, maybe in equal measure, would then pay very close attention to what Mozart had written in reaction to his works, and then he would write some himself. Mm-hmm. And this cross-fertilization went on for several generations. As a matter of fact, we planned a series of concerts. They would take two quartets, that is, two ensembles, to perform it, to play the Haydn that Mozart heard, and then what Mozart wrote, and then what Haydn wrote in response to that, and on and on and on. It would be fascinating for people who want to know where the great early quartets came from.
And then when it comes to Beethoven, I mean, now you're playing the longest of all the quartets, am I right?
With the fugue, I guess that's correct. Yes, it is.
Is it Opus 130?
Yeah, 130 and the Grosse Fuge.
Grosse Fuge is one of the last pieces of music I felt I could understand at all.
Good for you.
When I say at all, I don't mean I fully understand it, but at least I can follow it now.
I've been playing it most of my life, and I don't claim to understand it entirely. And that's part of the fun of returning to it. It is as modern as worthwhile music gets. It's just an astonishing piece to play. A giant mountain. And I use that term advisedly in this environment.
Right.
But each time you climb it, you take a different way up. And sometimes you fall off, and sometimes you make it to the top. And sometimes you make it to the top and the sun is shining.
If you have not heard the Grosse Fuge before, you've got to check this out. It's one of those pieces that should be on everybody's bucket list in their lives, I would say. And it comes after a quartet that has a lot of cheeriness and sunniness and pastoral qualities. Can you tell us a little bit about the other, whatever it is, five movements or so that precede it?
Yes. The first movement is large and learned and alternates a slow introduction, which returns several times with faster music. Then there's sort of a mini suite of three dance-related movements, a presto, a scherzando sort of movement, an andante, and then a tedesca, a German dance, an outdoor sort of heel of the boot first kind of dance. And then right before the Grosse Fuge is what Beethoven admitted was his favorite movement from all of his string quartets, and that's the cavatina.
Cavatina, yes.
Yeah.
Is that the one that has almost a musical depiction of sobbing?
Many people hear that. Yeah, many people hear that there. He marks a passage. They're very, very slow, solemn triplets in the lower three parts, and the first violin is playing anywhere but on the beat with lots and lots of rests. A breath is being caught all the time, and he marks it beklemmt, which is, I'm happy to say, nearly untranslatable, but it has to do with choking or oppressed.
Every string quartet that I've taught to, and I've taught to many of them over the years, they all talk about breathing into the music. You just started mentioning that. And this is one where it's more like choking, I guess, at least for that first violinist.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the importance of breathing in Haydn and in Beethoven? Did they use their understanding of the human voice to inform their string quartets? Or?
I'm certain that both of them did. I think Haydn to a greater extent. But Mozart, more than either of them, since Mozart, I believe, thought vocally, essentially, and Haydn composed mostly at the keyboard, as did Beethoven until the very late period when everything took place in his head. There was no need for any kind of instrument. Obviously, both of them wrote phrases longer than any human voice could sing, but shaping within those long phrases is as human as you could ask.
And are you a lover of vocal music then, yourself?
No.
You hear great singers.
No. The short answer for me, and again, an embarrassment to my colleagues, all of whom are much more open-minded about opera. My feeling about opera is that if the music is great, I don't need the silly libretto. And if the libretto is worthy as a play, I don't really need music to enhance it. There are, of course, some exceptions. And there are one or two Mozart operas. There's Lulu, there's Strauss, and so on. I enjoy beautiful singing, of course. And we've collaborated with a number of wonderful singers over the years, doing all kinds of things. Doing Respighi and doing Schoenberg II and things of that sort. But it's a very different approach to both making music and to experiencing music, I would say. Singers are a different life form, I find.
Let's talk about this Aspen premiere. Is it Robert Sirota?
Yes.
Right? Yes.
Yeah.
Tell us about Robert Sirota. Have you worked with him before?
Oh, indeed we have. Yeah. The first work of his that we played at all often was a quartet called Triptych. It was his response to the events of 9/11, particularly in New York. But like all music, which could be even halfway called program music, the music itself, I think, stands up very well. You could hear the work, know that it was about something serious, and not need to know more in order to experience it fully.
Mm-hmm.
But as it happens, when the audience knows that that's what it's about, it hits very, very hard. We played that for many years. We didn't record it because it was written for a quartet whose violist is the composer's son. So they had first dibs, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
But after he'd heard us play Quartet Number 1, which he revised, actually, once we started playing it, he said, you know, I've really got to write a quartet for the four of you, which he just did.
Mm-hmm.
And we recorded it about 2 months ago. It's an altogether different work, although his musical language is still his musical language. It is a setting, you might say, of, again, his responses to four different places in the United States that have meaning for him. And one of them is not all that far from here, being in Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm.
And the other's in New England, and of course, in the South. And finally, New York City. Can't do without it.
Yes. Can't live without it. So.
Some of us live in it.
Right. Is that your home base then?
Yeah.
For all
yeah.
of you?
Yeah. We're the quartet in residence at the Manhattan School of Music. We've been there since 1984.
Mm-hmm.
Two of us actually still live in the city, and the other two live a little ways up the river or a little farther up the river. The Hudson, we're speaking of.
Right. You just said something very controversial when you talked about opera and the low esteem in which you hold it. I'm hoping that I can dig out some other controversial opinions that you may have about music or about anything for that matter. are there things that it seems like you're the kind of person that likes to say things that are a little bit outrageous?
Only if they're what I believe. I'll give you a longish preamble and see if you can draw a conclusion before I get to any point. I first came to Aspen in 1958 as a kid, when the town was tiny and the festival was tiny and the tent was a tent held up with ropes tied to a pole.
Mm-hmm.
And in the afternoon concerts, when the wind blew up, the wind would fill the tent like a giant balloon and pick it up so that the center pole actually didn't touch the ground. And then when the wind died, it'd come down with a great bang. And as a young kid, that was my favorite part of any concert, I must say.
Right, no doubt.
Dirt roads, one-lane gravel road coming over the pass. You met somebody coming down as you came up. You pulled over so they could go down. Scary business. And then I came as a student in 1968, and it hadn't changed all that much. And, of course, the quartet has been here since our very first year, so every summer, without exception, since 1974.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen a lot of change here. Those who experience the festival as it now is, I'm sure, are delighted in every way. But there are some elements that I see have sort of slipped away, or that the balance has shifted in favor of large and glossy. But that may be true of every cultural endeavor. I'm not certain. Not many festivals can point to as long and rich a history as the Aspen Festival. So it's inevitable that some things would go better and some things would go awry.
So what are the things that you love about Aspen now? What are the things that you miss about Aspen since you go back so far, all the way back to the 50s?
Well, one of the things, I mean, it's in the nature of the attraction of chamber music relative to intergalactically famous soloists or large orchestral productions or opera productions for that matter, and also crossover hits. There's no denying that when a festival reaches a certain size, the box office has a commanding vote in what appears here and how much of it time and money is spent on. So chamber music has always been for the few. We don't dance around that. If you like to use the word elitist, then you may. By the few, for the few. And the people who come to chamber music concerts arrive with an appetite for it. They don't need to be convinced that it's good or important.
Mm-hmm. So you must be very happy that Harris Concert Hall was created.
Oh, no question.
Because, my goodness, it's one of the most beautiful halls in the country.
It certainly is. As a matter of fact, we played the very first chamber performance, not the first quartet performance there, but the first chamber performance. We did a Mendelssohn octet with a young quartet. It was sort of hands across the generations at that point. And they were new here. I think they were students. And we sat down with him and played the octet, which, of course, basically can't miss unless you fall off your chair. Actually, even if you do fall off your chair. But to return to the other half of your question about what we might miss, we often spent as long as 9 weeks here. And then we began to divide the 9 weeks with the Clevelands, either 5 and 4 or 4 and 5.
Mm-hmm.
And now no quartet spends more than about a week here.
Mm-hmm.
Not because they're not available or willing, but just because of the economics, I guess, of the situation. So that's something that we miss. We enjoyed being here. Not only because we like being here and performing more than once or twice or three times, but to have a greater influence on the students with whom we work. You blast in, you tell them to do this, tell them to do that. A week later, someone else is telling them the exact opposite. And it's not that they always have to do what you or anybody else says, but a longer relationship with students helps you to learn how they learn and how to help them more. That's one thing. The other thing is that, corny as it sounds, the Aspen Festival, for me, has always brought together a faculty which seemed more like a family than anything else. There are so many people who had been here just as many summers as we, and in a few cases, even more summers than we. And we had that shared experience. And of course, we've come full circle with your first question to me, because quartets that aim for greatness necessarily invest decades of time to get good at what they do and better every day if they have the patience and the humility to do it. And in some ways, it's a similar relationship between the people who spent so many summers here, learning how the festival works, learning what kind of students came here, learning how being in this extraordinary environment maybe shapes the way the kids made music or understood the importance of how they expressed what they felt and saw and smelled and tasted and all the rest of that.
I can say as a listener that every year when the Advanced Quartet Studies quartets play, they sound very good when they start. I mean, you get some really good talent.
Yes.
And by the end of the season, somehow, even with all the different quartets coming in, giving them contradictory information, somehow they maybe they circle the wagons away from you teachers or something, but for whatever reason, they seem to sound even better almost inevitably
at the end of the season. Well, you know, the level at which those quartets arrive, for the most part, not in every case, but for the most part, is such that they can probably try to do anything that any of us may suggest that they do. And they've also reached a level at which they already have learned how to learn. So we're not teaching them the one way to do any particular thing. We'll tell them what we do or what we've experimented with or what we understand from looking at manuscripts that Beethoven absolutely intended it, that the editors have erased by virtue of sort of purifying everything for print. But the fact that they know how to learn means that they can take what they like and leave the rest or return to it anon, you know.
Sometimes I imagine that every string quartet goes through a process where they have teachers, 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 and then at some point they have to start making their own decisions. And I think that they're, I'm hoping that there's a gradual process there where the teachers are kind of folding their arms and saying, what are you deciding now? And then letting them do that. But what happens? Do you see that a lot with quartets where they find their own process and then their voice really starts happening? And is it like something that just clicks one summer, or is it something that evolves more slowly over the years?
That's a good question. And I think it varies with each group. I find, for instance, that those who've been coached by teachers who insist on their, that is, the teacher's way, probably haven't recognized that they're being taught by someone who's weak, by someone who can't entertain more than one way. And to me, that suggests that whoever that teacher is either didn't spend very long in a professional quartet or didn't learn much from it. Because I think to make music in a quartet, you need strong opinions of your own. No one wants to work in a group of yes men because it would be tedious very quickly.
Yes.
But at the same time, you need to find a way to allow disparate ideas to coexist in your mind and in your group's interpretation, and the work may be played differently from night to night. So a good idea about how to play a passage or a movement or an entire piece or a genre belongs to the whole quartet, even if you change it tomorrow. And a bad idea is simply something that one of you suggests, you try, it doesn't take hold. And it doesn't mean that your thinking is bad or your music making is bad or you don't belong in the group. It simply means at that time on that day working on that piece with those people, something else found its way into the weave. So I think when quartets begin to recognize that, they're both exhilarated and maybe a little bit scared. And that's appropriate, I think.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. You can go unpack now.
Thank you. My great pleasure. I didn't bring all that much, but I did buy some wonderful peaches in Palisade. So those are waiting.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase. I'm Chris Moore, and I've been talking with violist Daniel Avshalomov of the American String Quartet about their recital this Thursday, August 10th. They'll be playing music of Haydn, Beethoven, and Robert Sirota. They also appear on the August 12th concert, along with the Aspen Contemporary Ensemble and others. They'll be performing a new work by Mohammed Fairuz. As I mentioned before, this Friday, August 11th at 8:30 at Harris Concert Hall, Piano Project List presents a free marathon performance with multiple pianists of List's late work, The Years of Pilgrimage. One of the pianists, Nitya Stapanukul, dropped by the Aspen Public Radio studio to talk about her part in this massive collective musical undertaking, as well as her own musical aspirations. Now, you started out in Thailand, and you said you came here at the age of 15.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your early training and how you got to the point that you were able to come here and study in Indiana and things like that?
Yeah, it's been quite a journey. So I started playing piano since I was 4, and I did my first competition when I was 10. By the age of 10, I knew that I really wanted to pursue music. And my teacher at the time, she went to Interlochen Arts Academy and graduated with a doctorate from Yale University. I wanted to follow her path, so I entered the boarding school at the age of 15 and tried it out.
Wow, well, congratulations. And, and then you made it. How many years have you been at the Aspen Music Festival now?
This is my second year.
Okay,
yeah.
Wonderful. There are a lot of competitions that take place up here, and there are also a lot of pianists doing a lot of things. I wonder how you and your fellow pianists generally feel about each other, because on the one hand, you're competing for the prizes that are available here and elsewhere, and on the other hand, you do the exact same thing.
I think it depends on the person, but I think generally all musicians are pretty supportive of each other, because we go through the same things and struggle together, like be happy together, make music together. It's everything, we're in it together. So I don't necessarily think of it as a competition as much of like supporting each other and like helping each other grow.
Let's get down to Franz Liszt, because coming up on the 11th at 8:30, Piano Project Liszt, The Years of Pilgrimage, which were some of his later piano works at Harris Concert Hall. Did you choose to be a part of this, or did your teacher say, we really want you to learn some Liszt and want you to be a part of this?
Well, I saw that there's this project coming up, and I did want to be a part of it. So I asked my teacher, I was like, oh, maybe I could learn some. And he said, sure, that sounds like a great idea, and just signed me up. And I'm like, okay, let's learn some Liszt.
Now, the later Liszt, when I think of Years of Pilgrimage, I think of, relatively speaking, perhaps more contemplative or more meditative, as opposed to the really flashy virtuosic pieces of his 30s and 40s. How do you see Liszt, now that you've been studying this piece that you're going to play, where does he fit in the world of music history?
If you're just talking about Years of Pilgrimage, it's basically a summation of all of his musical styles. Because there are three books. The first two are less flashy, less virtuosic, and more like exploring the harmonies, like progression, and it's kind of him still molding. But the third book is super flashy.
Yeah, so it's
more of like a representative of his later styles. But yeah, we're only doing the first two. As for Liszt himself, he's such a revolutionary character in the history of music. There's a famous quote that someone said, Wagner borrowed from him, Bartok stole from him, and women kept his cigar butts in their cleavages. Because he's such a ladies' man.
He was a sex symbol beyond belief. Well, I had heard that he was the first person to turn a piano sideways so that the woman could see his beautiful profile, his flowing hair and everything.
Yeah, basically his life was lived on stage all the time. In the evenings, just throughout the night, he would be making music, playing some of his own compositions, or like improvising, just wooing the ladies all night. And he basically invented the concept of like the pianist as a star, as well as the concept of masterclasses, because everyone wanted to study with him. So he would teach one student and everyone would gather around to listen to that. So that's how masterclass came to be, as well as solo recitals and memorization of repertoire.
You mean you can blame Franz Liszt for the fact that you had to memorize all these notes?
I wish.
No, but is that true? Is he the first one to create the expectation of memorized music for live performance instead of just music stands?
Yep.
So what does that do for you? Because I'm sure you play with music sometimes, but since Franz Liszt made you, from a historical point of view, made you become a memorizer as well, how much more deeply can you get into the music when it's so committed to memory that you don't even have to look at the notes anymore at all?
To be honest, I feel more comfortable when I have music memorized. Because before Liszt, if someone didn't use their music, it was kind of like a disregard to what's written on the page. They would just start improvising instead of playing what's on the page and what's written and being respectful of it. But after Liszt, he played everything that was on the page, including his own like interpretation of it, that it kind of revolutionized how people thought of performing without music. I think not using music helps you understand the music more deeply, because you have to understand it to be able to memorize it.
You talk about Liszt, almost the first thing you brought up was that he was such a ladies' man, but just being a Don Juan doesn't bring you importance, I think you might say. The music itself, there's a guy I knew, a professional pianist, not somebody who was one of the top pianists of the world or by any means, but a professional pianist who said, I never worked so hard to gain so little by studying Liszt, because he was studying one of the really difficult virtuosic pieces. And other people who I know just love Liszt and say that he's actually very rewarding. What do you find rewarding about Franz Liszt that makes you feel like it is worth that effort? Because it is a big effort to put his music into your fingers.
Yeah, it is. I agree that Liszt's compositions are extremely difficult, but that reflected on how he was as a pianist. He was a virtuoso. And Czerny's said that he was a natural who played with his feelings. And actually, he didn't just think about the notes. He thought about how he felt about it with extreme brilliance and precision instead of just learning the notes. Yeah, I think it's really rewarding once you get the techniques down and you feel what he feels.
Tell us what piece you're planning on playing and then what you have felt or how it has spoken to you.
So I'm playing the very first piece from the first book of Years of Pilgrimage, which is set in Switzerland. The piece I'm playing is called William Tell's Chapel, which has a very noble melody, but because it's depicting Swiss's struggle for liberation, he actually puts a very literary quote in front of most pieces in this suite. And the quote that he put before this one is from Schiller, where he said, "All for one, one for all." And so this noble melody sustains throughout the entire piece, but with a very underlining, heroic struggle. The right hand may have the melody with the left hand rumbling, switched.
How many of your colleagues are playing with you? How long is this concert that starts at 8:30, and how many different players are there?
I think at least five people. As of now, I'm sure there are more because there are so many pieces in the books. You'll just have to come and see.
I have to tell you, there's an old Superman movie, I don't remember which one it was, where the kingpin bad guy comes to one of his minions and says, "I ask you to do a simple thing like kill Superman, and you disappoint me." And I just feel like you've been asked to do a task just as monumental to take on a Liszt piece with a couple days' notice. That's incredible.
Yeah. Actually, we did something similar last year, too, with the Chopin mazurkas. It was a marathon of all the Chopin mazurkas.
Oh, my goodness, like 57 of them or something.
Yeah, and it was a three-hour-long concert. There were over 15 students playing, and I played one entire, opus number of four pieces and memorized it in 2 weeks. Yeah, so that was a challenge. I'm excited to do it again.
We're all looking forward to seeing you and your colleagues that day. So do come out and hear Liszt and Liszt and Liszt, a whole list of Liszt pieces. August 11th at 8:30 at Harris Hall, right?
Yeah.
Thank you again for coming down.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Nietzsche Stapanukul, who dropped by the Aspen Public Radio studio to talk about her part in a marathon musical undertaking this Friday, August 11th at 8:30 at Harris Concert Hall. Piano Project Liszt is a free performance with multiple pianists of Liszt's late work, The Years of Pilgrimage. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2017 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online on aspenpublicradio.org. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 for more interviews. Funding for Festival Showcase is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. Thanks for listening.